This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As information infrastructure collapses before our very eyes, making it difficult for public health officials to take stock of where we are, we can add that to the list of 2020 havoc. Yes, it's been sheer pandemonium from beginning to, well, middle. And we can be sure that pandemic, social revolution, a fraught election, and a crashing economy will be seen as singular and most likely historic by future generations. But remembered how? Will it be at the Museum of 2020? Who will put together the hydroxychloroquine exhibit? When will enough time have passed for historians to process what is now taking place? 5 years? 50 years? Nope. Turns out the process is already underway. Archivists across the country are already, or more to the point, always, collecting the artifacts that define the current moment for future museum goers. Anthea M. Hartig is the Elizabeth McMillan Director of the National Museum of American History, one of the Smithsonian's 19 museums and galleries. There, the suggestions for artifacts have run the gamut from Polaroids of medical staffers so that patients know the faces behind the masks, to protest signs, to a complete 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Anthea, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. It's an honor to be here.
The honor is ours. Conventional wisdom, and I define that, of course, as what I personally thought was true, it's that history is like a dinosaur skeleton that remains undisturbed for ages until historians and curators unearth the bones and try to put them back together. But evidently, that's the old school style of curating, if it ever reopens. What's the new school approach?
It's a great analogy, and it is somewhat dated and fossiliferous. Really, since the rise of what we call social history, kind of history from the ground up, history from the people's perspective, we've been examining those notions of what is historic, who makes history, and how is the perspective important, the great African proverb of the hunt from the hunter's perspective instead of the lion's perspective. And so we've been really trying as a profession to think about how that plays out in our collecting and what different strategies we need to work with people, with communities who are alive and who are experiencing history in the moment. And it is that really important working tension in between, you know, where does journalism start and history begin? And right now they're colliding, which I find in that incredible energy and excitement.
Now, we don't name federal buildings for dead political leaders for a while after their passing in order to get emotions to cool off and to provide a little historical distance. Current events can seem outsized in the moment, but more transitory and mundane sometime later, and not to mention more in focus, which would argue for the old approach. What is the benefit of digging right in?
The intensity of our collecting, especially around political collecting, started really after the Great March on Washington in 1963, where curators then realized they missed an opportunity. They didn't do as much. They didn't collect that moment. If we know we don't want to miss moments.
So even in the context of the way you've gone about your business the last number of decades, when this pandemic began, your museum announced that it was deploying a rapid response task force to begin collecting objects of the moment. Is there a historian consensus already that 2020 is a watershed year?
I believe so, Bob. We had a long history of documenting pandemics, epidemics, AIDS, H1N1, So we had known, working with the CDC, about the rise of the novel coronavirus late fall, early winter. So that part of our collecting and our mentality was already there, as well as we were already collecting in the field for the watershed 2020 election. So when those two came together, it was very clear to all of us here that it was imperative to document this moment, especially in ways that we hadn't before. We can't go out and collect as easily. We're asking people to hold things, the handmade signs. You know, a lot of this material is ephemeral and thus fragile and fleeting. And the response has been tremendous.
Now, this is not a perfect analog, but during the 1918 flu pandemic, we witnessed what might best be described as the anti-rapid response collecting process. It was basically a collector's worst nightmare. What happened?
H1N1, the so-called Spanish flu, where 30% of the world was infected, they estimate, and north of 500,000 Americans died, came at a very complicated time, of course, at the end of World War I. But two key things happened to memories. One, many of the objects themselves were destroyed and incinerated or just simply not saved, either, you know, for medical reasons or for personal reasons. And then two, when you're just finished a world war and still enmeshed in a lot of tensions domestically, there was a certain kind of shame of dying of the flu, where you could have died in war. And then the way in which people remembered was definitely changed and then really altered, I think, over time. And we don't learn about it in our history books, like we didn't learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre in 1921.
You're describing erasure.
Absolutely. The pain of those times, I think, maybe led to some personal erasure. And then the deficit of artifacts and materials also led to historians not kind of coloring back in those parts of the book that had been erased.
Now, that impulse for erasure could easily repeat itself in our circumstances today. Are you and your teams doing anything to get ahead of the psychology of trauma?
I think the most important thing we can do with the psychology of trauma is to acknowledge it, to be incredibly careful, filled with care, respectful of what people are going through, and that their first impulse might not be to save things from such a painful time. We're hoping, though, that they also feel a part of a community of memory in which they are contributing, whether it be their personal stories or their families or their businesses or their communities.
One of the grievances of the Black Lives Matter movement is that the story we tell ourselves about this country is whitewashed, that it is from a white perspective for a white audience, and everybody else has to just sort of fill in their own blanks. And that's why we see statues of slave owners and colonizers across the country coming down. As you collect historical artifacts of a nation in crisis in real time, what's the process for representing the whole of 2020 American society for the whole of future American society?
The way in which we go about telling the most inclusive and diverse set of stories we can rests on growing sets of scholarships, especially by scholars of color, and voices in the first person, really, from Phyllis Wheatley to David Walker through Frederick Douglass, and then well into the incredible flowering of Black and Brown voices throughout the 20th and now into the 21st century. So a big part of that is honoring, paying attention, and integrating that scholarship. Our lens for collecting COVID from the start, from March, has included a key face to the prism, if you will, of how we're looking at it through the lens of race and racism. And it's startling, the impact of institutional racism, denial of healthcare, all of that has magnified the impacts on people of color, and especially so many of whom are essential workers or frontline workers, whether they be in meatpacking plants in the Midwest or in hospitals in our major urban areas. So we're tracking that very carefully and wanting to make sure that, again, the fullness and the complexity of the story are all represented within both our intellectual framing of the moment, but also our collecting.
Now, look at Anthea. I've been talking about the Museum of 2020 as if it were a real thing, as opposed to, you know, let's say an exhibit of the year 2020 in your American History Museum. But should it be a discrete museum? Should someone be scoping out real estate on the National Mall?
For the Museum of 2020?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we owe it to ourselves to become the multipartite Museum of 2020. My hope for the work that we're doing as historians and curators and archivists and journalists is that we form a collective set of compassion, of empathy, of a world in which we understand how we're connected and how we need to find the resiliency to both combat these multiple pandemics and then to do our best to solve them and come out on the other side of history.
Anthea, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Anthea M. Hartig is the Elizabeth McMillan Director of the National Museum of American History. She's busy. Coming up, mind your P's and Q's. Anyway, your Q's. This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.